However, we are particularly concerned with the fact that in section 4.1d, Roman figure 2 of schedule 7 of the bill, there is still reference in our to section 21 company when we talk about non-profit companies, in which the non-profit company is equated as the successor to the current section 21 company. And those are some of the issues that we had raised with the department, and those issues were understood, and there was an undertaking that they would be dealt with in this present version. We think that it was an oversight that they were not, it was not dealt with. And this would go against the section I referred to in Schedule 7 of the bill, which makes provision for a company limited by guarantee, which is not a Section 21 company, to elect within 20 days of the effective date of the company's act coming into operation, either to be registered as a profit company or a non-profit company. If we still have this section in the memorandum of the object of the company's bill, which still equates non-profit companies to the Section 21 company, then it would mean that our unique corporate form as it exists now would not be accommodated. And what is more important about that, as I indicated earlier, is the fact that our core business is to collect, to license the usage of musical works, collect royalties, and then distribute those to the members. And we believe that if this is not attended to, it could create a situation where the courts would develop a jurisprudence in respect to non-profit companies that is based on precedents already dealt with regard to Section 21 companies. So we are proposing that particular reference in the memorandum be amended to actually indicate that not only Section 21 companies, but also other companies limited by guarantee, which are not Section 21 companies, constitute this non-profit making company or non-profit company as envisaged in the bill. The other issue that I want to bring to the attention of the committee is the issue of the definition of public company in the bill. Very specifically in the bill, the public company is defined as a profit company that is not a state-owned enterprise, a private company, or a personal liability company. This is not in line with the definition or the recognition of companies limited by guarantee and even Section 21 companies as being public companies in terms of the present Companies Act. So we would propose that reference to or definition of a public company to limit it to profit companies should be changed, because we are in essence a public company. We are a public benefit company, publicly listed, but for the fact that we are not a shareholding company. The other reference, which I believe is also a typographical issue, refers to Section 10, 2C of the bill, which makes reference to Section 67, 9, and 10, as well as Section 68. But going to the bill, you'll find that there is, in fact, no Section 67, 9, and 10. So I would then suggest that this should be amended, and if there was a particular purpose with regard to the insertion of those clauses or sections, then that the committee should relook at that and actually refer to the relevant sections. I think really those are the issues that we would like to bring to the attention of the committee as SAMRO. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Baloy. Members, questions, comments? From what I could gather, there was a specific reference and input in regard to SAMRO, the type of entity that SAMRO is and needs accommodation accordingly. Sisa, comrade.
Thanks, Chair. Now that I thought I was just about to be a good student of the company's legislation, something pops out. Limited by guarantee. Now, what does that mean? The second question is, SAMRO claims to be a public company, but at the same time, in essence, it operates as a non-profit company. How does it combine the two? So that's the question, because I had a different understanding of a public company. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate. Just those issues for clarification.
Okay. Thanks a lot. A public company is normally a publicly listed company in which shares are made available to the public. So you would have shareholders joining the company, and the company is thus called a public company. A company limited by guarantee is recognized in our law as a public company. Section 19(3) of the 1973 Act says that all companies limited by guarantee, including such existing companies, shall be deemed to be public companies for the purposes of the Act. So we have all along seen ourselves and been seen as a public company. In fact, our designation, our corporate form, we say SAMRO Limited, SAMRO LTD, and then we have limited by guarantee in brackets. So we are a public company. The difference between a company limited by guarantee and a public shareholding company is that rather than the members of the company contributing to the capital of the company by buying shares in the company, they contribute a certain limited amount, which is called a guarantee amount. So they are guarantors to the organization. In this situation, in terms of our memorandum of association, members agree that in the event that the company were to be wound up, they would contribute an amount of 2 rand towards the defraying of the cost of the company. So rather than shareholding, they then give a guarantee that they will contribute that amount. But this is a corporate form that has existed. As I said, in terms of the 1926 Act, there was this corporate form. There was both an association not for gain and a company limited by guarantee. And in terms of the 1973 Act, that company, that corporate form was carried over in terms of the protection given to existing companies.
There's still an aspect you are not clear on.
Okay, I think I'll be patient enough for the department to respond on this. It is understandable that you talk of a company which is recognized according to some old legislation and was protected under 1973. Now we're overhauling the whole legislation, and I mean, I understand it seems we're trying to bring together, different features, and out of it we expect a new form to exist. So rather than pronouncing much, Chair, as I say, let's see how the department responds on it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Advocate, thank you very much. Okay. I'm sure your issues will be taken on board by the department. My timesheet says that the next presentation is Kosatu, but I can't hear anybody saying Viva yet. Nor can I see NEDLAC here. I see one component here, government. I can't see business and labor. So that brings me to Mr. Dan Ribbons. Dr. Rabi, I take it that call was from Ms. Helen Zill. It was from your own local government. Mr. Robbins, we are in your ambulance as soon as you are ready. I trust that today your voice is back.
Chairman, thank you for having regards to my voice and for granting me a remission on the first day when I was asked to trot out and for keeping the slot open until today. I hope my voice will last the presentation and that the audience will also last and bear what I have to say about some possibly esoteric matters and some practical matters. Yes, thank you indeed for the invitation, and I should point out perhaps that I obtained a copy of the bill about a week ago, and in view of the circumstances, the short time available, I've not been able, obviously, to study it at any length or in depth. What I basically did, I cherry-picked some sections or some clauses with which I was, or the precepts I was familiar with in the past, and I tried to put something together in that regard. And what I will be doing, I will essentially kick off with a brief review or brief some views, submissions with regard to the equivalent of the section 228. What is that now in the new bill? Is it 35? It's clause 115. And I will be nitpicking there and making certain submissions, and I will also be referring to some other sections. But I think what I must say is that, as an overall perspective, my focus is on an entity that is not possibly before this panel in a direct sense. I'm referring to the Close Corporation, and I'm going to draw some comparisons between some of the provisions I'm addressing, and I will present a case why I believe the bill should not proceed or should not contain the clauses or the provisions whereby, as I understand it, at the little time I had at my disposal, to basically prevent or rather fetter the right of entrepreneurs or other businessmen in future, once the new bill becomes law, to incorporate as incorporated partnerships. So there will be a heavy slant on close corporations and the type of company it represents. In that regard, I should also point out that I am making submissions with regard to the derivative, statutory derivative action, and the provisions in that regard, which are clearly vast. I haven't been able to study them in any detail, but I am making some comments and submissions in passing. And I am making a radical submission in again drawing a distinction on the one hand what the Continentals call the Germans call it the Kapitalgesellschaft, the French the Société de Capitaux, and I think the best English translation therefore would be joint stock companies. It's a company that basically is funded by the issue of shares and etc. on the one hand, and on the other hand again the personal company type of which the close corporation is the representative in South Africa. But the radical proposal submission I'm putting before you, and it's something I have put before the authorities, the stock exchange in 1994 when they requested comments on the revision of the listings requirements, and the proposal is that the policing of wrongs that are perpetrated in with regard to stock exchange listed shares or securities, private policing provisions should be made, enabling provisions should be brought in, not necessarily in the Companies Act, but possibly in the stock exchange rules with regard to permitting policing of that nature. And I will explain why I say that. But I think events during the last decade has borne out that something radically is wrong, and that the provisions or the record or measures whereby tort features of that nature can be brought to account and to book should be strengthened and perhaps made. I'm not suggesting that the present ones are bureaucratic, but perhaps they do not work because it's too expensive. That therefore I'm proposing a private policing dispensation, but then only again, and let me stress, not necessarily for, specifically not for the close corporation type, the private personal company type, where common law remedies exist whereby those people can look after themselves. I'm addressing these I'm directing this particular suggestion and submission with regard to private policing, not in any way at ordinary public companies, but only to companies listed on the stock exchange. And you will see that I base my ideas and my submission in that regard on a decision of Lord Denning's event was in the matter of Wallerstein versus Moore. I think it was a 1964 decision, a copy of the I've attached extracts of relevant portions from that judgment. That basically is an overview. Let me then proceed and quickly run through some aspects of the paper that I have submitted to the committee. I say that the stated aim of bringing company law in line with the values underpinning the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa and with the provisions of the Bill of Rights, in particular but without limitation, the right to freedom of association in Section 16 of the Bill of Rights is lauded and supported. I point out that it is noted that the authors of the bill before the committee sought the advice of a small panel of international experts drawn from South Africa's major trading and investment partners as well as Commonwealth jurisdictions which share many of our company law traditions before publishing a draft bill for public comment in February 2007. I wasn't fortunate enough to see that bill with the provisions, but I make reference to this particular statement for the I say these experts are not identified, nor are the source from which they draw and on which they rely. Although the bill addresses companies and not corporations, there are many indications that to a large extent reliance has been placed by the drafters on models from North America, and in particular it seems the Canada Business Corporations Act 1975, which I understand is now officially called the Canada Business Corporations Act, RS RS 1985, revised statutes 1985, so there have been a fair amount of amendments there. The relevance of the Canada Business Corporations Act, I deal with further in an attachment. It is, which should be before the committee. The relevance of the Canada Business Corporations Act is that it introduced into Canada, which up to the 1970s had company legislation which to some extent was comparable with the South African situation. They were basically English acts, but unlike South Africa where we had a singular Companies Act 46 of 1926 since that year, and then the Companies Act 1963, Canada with its number of provinces has had a large number of Companies Acts which were very confusing. So to this extent, the Canada Business Corporations Act, which followed the Ontario Act, of 1970, was a welcome breath in cleaning up the debris of the past. The authors of this particular act, the draftsmen of the particular act, Dickerson and I think it was Professor Jacoby or Ziegel of Toronto, have openly stated in their preface and their submissions that they have relied very heavily on the ideas and on the works of Professor Harry Ballantyne of California. Now, I have, for your benefit, because it seems esoteric, it seems nobody would hardly have heard of Ballantyne, but I've attached a short note at the back as an attachment where it is clear why he was held in such regard and why his ideas swept Canada, and after Canada, it also swept Australasia, New Zealand, but not Australia. Australia has I referred to those developments, and let me just interrupt myself. I deem these concepts and this information relevant from the point of view of the stated aim of the bill being to bring us in line with and having had regard to our trading partners and ideas in company law. And I suggest we have regard to what, for instance, Professor Seely says about the unworkability of the new Australian Companies Act by virtue of its length and its sheer size and its arcane provisions. It stands in stark contrast to the Canada Business Corporations Act and the writings of Professor Ballantyne. So, to the extent that our bill has in fact, and there are a number of indications that have caused me to believe that our bill is in fact based to some extent or to a large extent on the Canada Business Corporations Act, I think it's laudable. But I must also point out that unwittingly, some of the less beneficial doctrines of North American law, as through the back door, entered the Canada Business Corporations Act, the so-called concession theory, which is also something, it sounds esoteric, which I deal with in some of the attachments. It is not just a matter of theory and esoteric concepts. There are provisions in our bill, which I will get to towards the end, which seem to be falling foul of this very difficulty that was introduced, this very problem that was introduced by the Canada Business Corporations Act in Canada. And some of those difficulties hinge around the concept, well, the provisions of, is it 15.7? The shareholders agreement, and then as at 66, the management to the board must manage. Now, okay, I've transgressed a bit. I've pointed out here that the bill refers to companies and not corporations. Whereas our Close Corporations Act quite strangely refers to corporations. It in fact should be a company, and this should be, depending on from what angle one comes, but a purist would say that what we're dealing with now is a corporation, and that the Close Corporation Act is actually a company, but I'll try and explain that in more detail. It'll become apparent. Then just let me then continue with what I've suggested here. Yes. One of the nitty-gritty, one of the hands-on situations, sections or clauses I deal with, the section corresponding to the clause 115 of the bill, section 228 of the Companies Act. I will get to that presently. I say in passing, I note the question of the legal nature of the share of a company, clause 35 of the bill, will be reviewed, and I will get to that. I will also refer in passing to clause 165 of the bill, and I should state up front that I have a difficulty with the suggestion that, or the proposal that, is it in 266? No, it's the suggestion is made, or the proposal is made, that the common law rights, basically the derivative rights, be abolished. And I will explain why I believe that should not be done, and I'm also suggesting that it could create problems under Section 39(2) of the Bill of Rights.
As you go along, could you also carry us with you just to reference now and then on which page you are?
Sorry, I'm back to page 4 now. I'm now, I've given you an overview, I'm now going to run through from page 4. Thank you, Chair. It seems to me that clause 115 of the bill is intended to supersede section 228. Of the Companies Act 1973, and to introduce relevant arrangements with respect to analogous situations. Clearly, clause 155 is much broader than 228, but I do have some difficulties with that, which I will address. I point out that section 228 is a superseded section 70 deck of the Companies Act 46, and that the latter section was not inspired by the English legislature. It was a provision that was taken over from America, and the first exhibit that I've attached to the papers is an article which shows this background and the fact that the American judiciary has dealt with some of those difficulties that the American practice picked up. And by the way, this provision came to South Africa via the London Stock Exchange. And then it came into our company legislation in somewhere in the 50s or 70 deck. But there are omissions, and there are situations that need to be addressed in this regard. And I've addressed that previously in the article that is attached as Exhibit 1, which I will briefly give you the gist of. Maybe the first paragraph, reading of the first paragraph would suffice. Chairman, how are we going full time? Am I running late?
Continue, sir. At this time, you are still having the benefit of a captive audience.
I doubt that, but I will see whether I can capture them in the time that's available. Thank you, Chair. Disposals by company of assets are not uncommon occurrences. Trading companies are wont to resort to clearance sales, some once, others more than once a year. Share dealing companies are viable only to the extent that they are able to switch into the right holdings from time to time, which may even mean momentarily being completely liquid. Township development companies exist in order to liquidate portfolios acquired and developed by them, and then start the process all over again. Retailers in other fields must turn over their stocks at a much faster tempo in order to make ends meet. Now, where did we stand with that situation under Section 228? Where do we stand? with the proposed clause 115, is it? My submission is, let me point out that this article shows that the American judiciary has crafted, the Americans have in their statutory law, in their statutes, they have not crafted exceptions to this basic prohibition. The American judiciary has come forward with some solutions, and by and large, it is to distinguish between ordinary course of business transactions and transactions that are not in the ordinary course of business. And that is one way to go. There's another way, and I favour the other way, but I'm not sure, and this is for consideration, which is the better way. It is for consideration, and it's my submission that what should be taken, the section, the clause should be made, should clarify that disposals of trading stock, as defined either by GAAP or by the IFRS rules, trading stock should not be, should not trigger the provisions of this clause. It should be excluded in a definition. I also further propose, because there is conflicting decisions of our courts, what a disposal is, whether it includes a loan and a mortgage bond, etc. There are earlier decisions whereby it is held that such transactions, a loan or a mortgage, is in fact a disposal. And I think there's a later decision by the late Mr. Justice Margo somewhere in the 80s, whereby it held that it's not. I believe that decision is incorrect, because Justice Margo was not, the earlier cases weren't cited, and he did not have regard to them. I believe the solution lies in this regard, and this is what I've mooted in that this article I'm referring to already, is that like in the Insolvency Act, the concept of disposal should be clearly defined, what it includes and what it does not include. It is for consideration whether the definition in the Insolvency Act, or whatever it's going to be called in the new dispensation, should be incorporated by reference, or whether a new definition should, more or less on those lines, but I think the same concepts should possibly be used, and to the extent necessary, amplified or amended. But I think it should be a stand-alone definition of disposal, and like in the Insolvency Act, it should be clear that a disposal is not only the act of implementing the disposal, as we say in Afrikaans, die saaklike ooreenkoms, the real transaction, the putting it into effect, but also, as it's put in Afrikaans, die verbintenisskep in ooreenkoms, I think it is called the contractual or the obligationary agreement. It's not only the actual delivery or implementation, it is also, the disposal is also the contractual or whatever transaction gives rise to it. I note that in the bill, reference is made to a series of transactions. Now, that covers, that deals with it to some extent, but I believe not fully and not adequately, and creates problems of its own nature. Do we have a situation now that this provision, in a normal course of business transaction, you dispose of something, and now you find out that there have been disposals of this nature over the last 10 years. And the disposal of this long asset triggers the rule. I don't think that could be intended, but I'm not sure how it should be dealt with, but it's something that should be considered in my submission. I've also not had the time of studying the Act in any detail. I'm not sure to what extent the Act follows the example or follows the lead taken by the legislature and the Close Corporations Act of doing away with the Turkmen rule, etc., etc. But To the extent that the Turkmen rule still survives, and there might be doubt about it, and I think Ennisberg refers to the fact that the particular clause does not deal with or say where this is left with Turkmen, the situation might be cured, but the cure might be the curse might be worse than the cure. What I'm suggesting is that consideration might be given to stating that a disposal in contravention of the statutory dispensation is beyond the capacity of the company with the consequences that would ensue under the provisions of the bill. It's just for consideration. It is something that will have to be thought through, in my view. It could go too far. Before I leave the topic of, let me call it 228, I'm not so familiar with clause 115, it hasn't stuck in my mind yet, 228 has. Problems on our stock exchange, and by the way, I do not, I was about to refer to the stock exchange. The 228, the clause 115 situation, again, is a provision that you would find with capital companies, stock exchange companies, public companies. You will hardly find it in a close corporation. You could, but your common law remedies in the case of a close corporation would deal with this sort of problem to a large extent. And in passing, I will briefly refer you to an American decision from Massachusetts, Rod versus Donahue. It's not on all fours, but I'm trying to give you the idea what the rules in the close corporation and that type of company are capable. In this matter, usually in a close corporation you don't have many shareholders, you only have a couple. And in that situation, some of the shareholders bandied together and they bought back their shares, but not pro rata, their stock, but not pro rata. The buying back was permitted. But what was offensive was they were effectively paying themselves a dividend to the exclusion of the other shareholders or the stockholders that were overlooked. Now, I'm using that as an example to tell you that I believe the application and the implementation of those norms would prevent problems. Would prevent the problems that are envisaged, that are addressed in clause 115. So I'm not saying take out the equivalent of 115 or 228 out of the Close Corporations Act, but the common law rules developed in respect of the close in partnership and then applied to close corporations adequately deal with the situation. But that brings me back to my final suggestion, submission with regard to 228. And that is the definition. I previously referred to the definition of what is included in a disposal. I think taking into account what's happened on the stock exchange, it should possibly include a transaction like a scrip lending transaction. Because we have seen in some what is now coming out in the press, JCI and Ron Gold, the allegations are that Section 228 has been infringed, and the value of the assets who have been disposed of, they were listed securities, are reputed to be worth $14 billion. Now, I'm just pointing that out in passing. I believe in the case of the stock exchange company, in this bill, for instance, the definition should be expanded and should possibly go beyond what was previously in the Insolvency Act definition. That, I think, brings me to on page 7. Chair, how are we for time? Thank you, sir.
I'm saying that at this stage you have pushed 20 minutes but you still have us.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
And I'm sure you started indicating that you are going towards a conclusion.
I'm a third way, but I will try and cut quickly now. Okay. Now, what I'm saying on page 7, I say that, again, looking at the Close Corporations Act section of the Provisions Clause 35, show with the necessary, as people are want to say, and other lawyers will say, mutatis mutandibus, with the necessary adaptations referred to Section 91 of the Act. But comparing it to the Close Corporations Act, and I'm not saying that that is the norm, but I'm saying, I'm making out a case that it is not necessary in South African law, unlike English law, to say that a share is movable property. That issue was decided in Holland in the year 1653 already, when the issue came up. The question was, do you pay transfer duty when you transfer shares in the Dutch East Indian Company or the Dutch West Indian Company by virtue of the fact that they own land? Do you pay the fiscal authorities the hererecht, the transfer duties? And the answer is no, for the simple reason the company, as they put it, is a body corporate. A corpus mysticum, it's a body corporate. Now, I mention this because in English law, English-American law, there was still a debate in the late 1890s whether a share is movable or not, and that is the reason why it is found in English Companies Act, and we took it over without questioning. Now, it wouldn't do much harm, but where we now have a provision in the Close Corporations Act where we refer to a member's interest and we don't state that it's movable property, it could create doubt. I also have some views on I looked at that section on a beneficial interest, and I found it's very difficult, and obviously one will have to, as one of the previous speakers said, one more time is needed to actually address this. I have basic difficulties, although I know that the concept of beneficial interest or beneficial ownership perhaps has been referred to in our Stamp Duties Act. You pay stamp duty when beneficial ownership or beneficial is changed, and I know it's been brought into the Companies Act in 1998, but the concept of beneficial estate or beneficial ownership is unknown to South African law. That is the essence of the English law of trusts, is the dichotomy, the distinction between legal estate and legal title and beneficial estate. And it has been held all over in jurisdictions by courts. For instance, in Canada and Louisiana with a French background, and also our courts, that the concept of legal estate and the legal title and beneficial ownership is unknown to our law. Not as recently. In 1985, our Supreme Court of Appeal, our appeal court as it then was, again, in no uncertain terms, reiterated that South African law does not have beneficial estate. So I'm not sure where, I take the point that the Act refers to beneficial interest, but I am saying that the ramifications of this should be considered. Just off the top of my head, do we now have a trust? Can we now say we have a trust of shares? Does the English law the English principles of trust law apply to shares because we have a beneficial interest? Is this tantamount to beneficial estate? It is something that I've not addressed, but it will have to be considered. I leave it at that. It brings me to clause 165(1) of the derivative action. And here I endeavour to make the point that it is not clear to me, and I'm not sure whether it's clear to other lawyers and persons, what the reason is for trying to abolish common law rights that are referred to. I take it they refer to the derivative action, but what actually is, where do we find this animal? What are its limits? What is the definition of the common, or is it a vague concept? And if we're abolishing it, what else are we throwing out with this abolition? Now, I go on to show that this could have problems under Section 39.2 of the Constitution, in terms of which a court, a tribunal or a forum is enjoined to develop the common law in line with the values, etc., of the Constitution. And I'm not sure that this will pass muster, but I personally have difficulties because I endeavour to show in the light of the judgment of Lord Denning I referred to earlier, how that very enterprise and creative, rational judge helped the development of the derivative action, and how he was basically the assistance that he rendered in that matter, how that was echoed in the Canada Business Corporations Act, the derivative suit provisions, in particular the right of the applicant to cost. Now, I'm not sure that brief glance I've taken at that in our bill is satisfactory. It's something that I think needs to be revisited, but the point I make is that the proposal whereby the common law rights are abolished goes far too far, and I think it is not acceptable, particularly if one has regard to the reasoning of Lord Denning, how he referred to agency and trust law, how in those situations the derivative action is how the party, the trustee or the whosoever comes to court is entitled to be indemnified out of the assets of the trust or the principal, etc., etc. Now, South African common law goes much further than that. We have the institution of what is called saakwaarneming, or the Latin negotiorum gestio, handling the affairs of another. And I'm not sure to what extent this proposal will put a line through it. I don't think it's a good thing. And in fact, I think it's a bad thing. I then proceed to in the next heading to, yeah, there I refer to Lord Denning and that decision.
Yeah, now on page what?
I'm on page 11 now. In essence, what I'm proposing here, Chairman, and bear with me, I have hopped around, but I believe you do have the benefit of reading these documents subsequently, and I have emailed to the committee the attachments where these various concepts are set out in greater detail, so as not to burden you with the detail. Basically, on page 11 and following, I endeavour to make out a case for private policing, and what I'm saying is, in a sense, I think it could be seen as analogous to the derivative action, but then only in the case of stock exchange companies, because the need to move is so much more urgent and so much more is at stake. And what I'm basically suggesting is, Lord Denning said that he had a difficulty in granting the order he did, because in the case of the company law, there wasn't that contractual relationship on which he found support on which he could rely in the case of agency or trust. But in South African law, let me put it to you this way. A company, when it lists its securities on the stock exchange, one of the documents it files is an agreement by the directors and by the company in terms of which it undertakes to abide by and adhere to the rules of the stock exchange. Now, in terms of South African law, that agreement, the premise, let me go back to the premise. In South African law, we have what is called an agreement for the benefit of third parties. In English law, that did not exist, I'm sure, at the time, under the influence of the European community. English law was changed in the year 2000 to permit such type of contract, but this was before Lord Denning's decision. But it is not inconceivable that if English law had an agreement for the benefit of a third party, Lord Denning might have based his ruling with regard to the costs and analogous relief in favor of the shareholders bringing the application and the proceedings against the tortfeasors. He might have based it on contract, and I'm saying we should look at that and we should consider persuading the stock exchange in the undertaking it requires from a to-be-listed company to spell out in that agreement that the agreement also operates for the benefit of shareholders of that company, and that those shareholders are in given situations entitled to proceed to enforce the regulations to the extent that nobody enforces them. Now, I was present, and I've been aware of that previously. I was present when it was suggested that, well, it was mentioned that minority shareholders or aggrieved shareholders, I think in fact it was the speaker that spoke just before lunch, could use this to blackmail. But that's my suggestion is that a provision be introduced whereby, let's put it differently, provisions corresponding to what is known as, I remember in my days as a prosecutor, a nulla prosequi. You cannot, prosecution is the prerogative of the state, but if the state doesn't prosecute, an individual can conduct that prosecution, but only if the Attorney General or prosecutor, my standing prosecutor, has issued a certificate that the state is not willing to prosecute. Now I'm suggesting that something similar be provided for with regard to stock exchange companies, because this is actually where the major damage is done, not in the case of the private company, the small, what the Americans call the mom and pop, the shop around the corner, not your close corporation. The harm to the economy is done, and I've attached some extracts from an article by Mr. Richard Sauer of SEC in America, which was published in the Business...
Mr. Raman, you are going to the detail now. I would like to suggest that you start concluding now. We have given you 30 minutes.
Sir, I thank you. That is my case in essence with regard to the private policing. I believe it's urgent. If this, and I've heard submissions that this act, this bill might not go through, and it shouldn't go through until all the problems are ironed out. Should that happen, or in any event, I believe that something should be done about the stock exchange situation and that private policing should be seriously considered. And then my last section, Chair, I basically address the case for the retention of the close corporation. And in essence, if I'm pressed for time, I think I've set it out there in quite some detail, also in the attachment. In a nutshell, as an American once put it, one of the American commentators, you do not endeavor, you do not try to legislate safety regulations in the same statute for macro jumbo jets on the one hand and tricycles on the other. And if you think about it, what will result is something very bad. Because if you compromise in any modicum the safety of your jets, they will all fall out of the sky. And on the other hand, even if you make massive concessions to the tricycles, it will still be too expensive for them to comply. And I believe that for that reason, we should keep what I try and explain here as the personal company, of which the Continentals call it the Société, or the Capital, the Person in the Chancellor, the Société des Personnes, the close corporation. It has a right of existence in itself, on its own, and it should be... It should be cultivated and nurtured, not be abolished. Thank you, Chair.
Reverend, you have gone through your whole presentation. You had the benefit of us as a captive audience, because we are also hoping that whilst we have given you exactly 40 minutes, we might have the other presenters here. We don't seem to have them. So, members, any questions, comments? Sisa?
Chair, Mr. Ribbons has said more than a mouthful. He really has said more than a mouthful. Well, small question is regarding his submission around clause 56, the beneficial interest. He claims that beneficial ownership or estate is not part of South African law, and he proposes that this clause should be revisited, but I didn't pick up what he's proposing as an alternative, unless I'm expecting too much. But one of the practices is that most of the time alternatives, you know, are presented so that you can look into that. Because at some stage I thought he might be saying that let's introduce the doctrine of beneficial ownership or beneficial estate, because there is this clause 56 which alludes or handles beneficial interest. I think that's basically my specific question, but my other proposal is more general, is that at times one gets lost in the document as to specifically what alternatives or what is Mr. Ribbons proposing. If he could be considerate enough to just redraft or recraft his documents such that his proposal get crisp and clear. I'm not alluding to the explanatory notes or the motivations, but to say in each and every clause 115, clause 228, clause 56, you know, because I've been at pains in trying to pick up at times, other than his explanation, but he's not going to be with us every time, so that would be very helpful, Chair. Thanks, sir. Oh, just a small thing. He says that experts have not been identified. I trust Mr. Ribbons, you must place trust on DTI. They definitely have been consulting experts, but of course it's up to them to respond to that.
Mr. Rubens, your rejoinder, sir. Return your mic, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Speaker, for the questions. I will endeavour to deal with them. Now, the first one is the most difficult. Let me try, and I'm not being evasive, but let me quote from what has been said in other jurisdictions about beneficial estate. The Supreme Court of Canada at one stage said on appeal from Quebec, the civil law of Quebec does not admit of the dichotomy legal title and beneficial estate. A court in Louisiana said, if anything is more interesting than the chapter on snakes in the complete history of Ireland, it is a trust code in a civilian jurisdiction. Regardless of the number of angels that can dance on the point of a needle, no two persons can own the same property at the same time. He was referring to legal and beneficial estate. Now, I do know in practice we sort of skirt around the issues. I cannot come up with a clear-cut suggestion how we should deal with it, but I align myself with what Attorney Narinder Feinstein said, that this is a vast, this is a mouthful, this particular proposal, and I think it should be thought through very carefully before we bring it into operation because it's going to have ramifications, far-reaching ramifications. And on that score, Chairman, Chair, if you'll allow me a second, I'm also at loss, and I think this is clearly under the influence of the Canada Business Corporations Act, one of the less beneficial aspects of it, that we've done away with the known concept in English company law of membership and shareholdership. And I think we'd import a free fall without that concept. Now, to get honourable member, to get back to your other questions, if I remember, you want me to be specific. I think I have been specific with regard to 115. I will put, it's all in the article I've enclosed, attached the exhibit, other than possibly the reference to script lending. But I think one should think creatively, and one should look at other similar situations to spill them out and include them. As far as, which is the other section, I'm not happy with the wording of, was it 165.1b, despite the wording of, and then they referred to the, but I can put this in writing, and then I have very strong views, and I would love to put them in writing about the private policing, because maybe there's a police background, a police whatever, in my background. Now, I feel very strongly about the private policing of the stock exchange, and you will see the article of I attached Richard Sauer, in stock manipulation and etc. The accounting mispractices on stock markets, where he shows that how billions of dollars are wiped out if fraud is discovered. The integrity of the markets and of the economy and of the well-being of nations are compromised if this is not policed properly. And I don't think this should be left to, I think, let me put it differently, I think private policing is more sensible, because there will be people that will stand up for their rights if they're empowered to do it financially through the company. And then with regard to the close cooperation, I have said quite a mouthful there, but I can summarize that in a nutshell. Do not bring into operation the provision whereby incorporations under the Close Corporations Act, under the new Corporations Act of South Africa, the bill will be abolished. And in the light of that, please tighten up, please align, please look at the Close Corporations Act again. And I think in view of what other people said, and I agree with that, once you put something into legislation, it takes years to revisit it. I believe whatever warts may attach to our present Companies Act, the ship won't go down. We can patch it until we have crafted an act that is entirely satisfactory in all respects, and until we have, before we put that into operation, we've also revisited our Close Corporations Act so that the two can work in symphony and in harmony. I hope that has answered the question.
Mr. Evans, thank you very much. You got your answer, Chief.
Thank you, Chairman, and I thank you and the audience for, if they're not captive, for at least listening, and I hope that some of the ideas and I'm happy at any time to elaborate upon that. If the member honourable member wishes to pass on his particulars, I will elaborate on that. And I'm not sure whether it's permitted. I haven't started looking at the other provisions yet. I've only looked at, as I've said, I have cherry-picked and I've nitpicked in some respect. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. Switch off your mic, please. You did say you are going to deal in part with the esoteric. You did deal with it substantially, I might add. Thank you for your input. Members, Saraj, we have not heard from Nedlec and Kosatu. Good folks, we're supposed to have had written submissions from all presenters, and we extended time to Nedlec and Kosatu. to come and make their presentations and come with their submissions. We have not seen them. We have come to the end of the presenters that we do have with us. So we'll see what we do as a way forward. We'll have to discuss the way forward with the department. So what I propose is that we end today's session, and then I'll take discussion with the department and state law advisors. I'm sure you'll be informed as to how we move forward. Members, Marcel points out that in terms of the package of written submissions that you have received, there was no number 15. Apparently, number 15 was submission H, which was presented by Weber Wenta. So those are the only written submissions that you have. What is Mr. Labuskagne?
Yes. Chair's submission 2 from the Sugar Association relates to the Competition Act.
So if it relates to the Competition Act, yeah, we are not dealing with the competition. We are dealing with companies. Good folks, at this stage, we'll meet on Wednesday to take the process forward. Thank you.